Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Welcome to Ruination, the early years. I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
So, imagine discovering a massive, undeniable glitch in your absolute favorite digital platform. You take the time to write a polite message to the creator, letting them know, hey, the system is broken.
Right, just being helpful.
Exactly. And instead of a thank you or, I don't know, a standard customer service apology, the creator publicly shames you on their broadcast.
Oh, it's brutal.
Yeah, they accuse you of having faulty hardware, tell you that you live in a glass house, and then in a display of pure, unchecked authoritarianism, demand that you perform two random acts of kindness as a moral penalty for daring to question their software.
It is honestly the ultimate flex of creator hubris. I mean, you are essentially telling your audience not to believe their own lying eyes or... In this case, they're failing hard drives.
It's wild. But today we have a very specific mission for you as we take a deep dive into the source material.
We really do.
We are bypassing the polished, you know, hyper-curated feeds of the modern internet. We're dragging you back into the unapologetically chaotic mud of early independent broadcasts.
Back to the Wild West?
Yes. We are extracting the most fascinating, chaotic, and revealing nuggets from a single, highly concentrated week in the archives of the big, fatty online universe. We are looking specifically at the week of Monday, July 28th, through Friday, August 1st, 2008.
Which is such a crucial era. And to truly understand the psychological whiplash we're about to unpack, we need to briefly ground you in who Big Fatty actually is.
Right.
And more importantly, the extreme dualities of his life. He is a classically trained, highly educated, white-collar worker.
Yeah, he's got a real corporate job.
Exactly. He spends his days trapped in a soul-crushing corporate environment that he repressively refers to as the coal mine. That is his reality from 9 to 5.
But the moment the clock strikes and he escapes the coal mine, he retreats to his sanctuary.
His true domain.
Right. He broadcasts daily from his Fat Cave, which is a studio located inside his craftsman-style home he affectionately calls the Villa. And from that fortress, he delivers exactly 20 minutes of explicit, unapologetic, and wildly entertaining daily audio directly to his community.
And, you know, 20 minutes might not sound like a lot today, but in the landscape of 2008... maintaining a daily solo broadcast required an immense amount of stamina.
Oh, totally. You can't just scroll TikTok for content.
No, you had to mine your own life for content every single day.
Mm.
And the thematic arc of this specific 5-day stretch perfectly illustrates the toll that takes.
It really does. It's a week that begins with sheer agonizing physical exhaustion, takes a deeply bizarre detour through aggressive community management and, like, pop culture warfare.
And then it ultimately ends with a spectacular collision between Big Fatty's massive ego and a global Apple software glitch.
So to really grasp Big Fatty's mindset as this week opens on Monday, July 28th, you have to look at the physical reality of his weekend.
Yeah, he is running on fumes.
We are witnessing a moment where his deep, unwavering commitment to his community directly clashes with the biological limitations of his own body.
The itinerary he maintained over the weekend is, well, it's staggering for a solo creator who also works a full-time corporate job.
It's a lot.
He took a group called the Tiara Har 4 on the road up to Myrtle Beach for a dedicated fundraiser. And preceding that, on Friday night, they hosted a basket raffle at Patrick's Pub in Charleston.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because we need to put this into the economic context of late July 2008. The global economy is literally starting to crack in half.
Oh, it's terrifying.
The housing market is collapsing, gas prices are astronomical, and people are terrified about their financial futures. Yet, through this basket raffle and the Tiara event, Big Fatty manages to raise $693 for charity.
Which is incredible.
For an independent broadcaster to convince an audience to part with nearly $700 in cash at a local pub during the onset of the Great Recession, that requires an ironclad level of trust and community loyalty.
It really is a massive achievement. But the schedule doesn't stop to let him celebrate. By Sunday night, he is completely exhausted, yet he still has to push through a grueling rehearsal for a local stadium production called the Buxy Blues.
Right, the Buxy Blues.
Yeah, which he mentions is set to run from September 12th through the 28th. So by the time he hits the microphone on Monday, He is physically dragging.
I mean, you can hear it.
You really can. He openly admits to you, the listener, that there is no rest for the weary and that he desperately needs a weekend of having absolutely nothing to do just to physically recover from his own charitable endeavors.
But wait, before that exhaustion fully set in on Sunday, he squeezed in one more major physical excursion on Saturday morning, and this is where the week takes its first turn into the bizarre.
Oh boy. The Apple Store.
Yes. At exactly 10 a.m., he and his longtime friend Larry Cly attended the grand opening of the new Apple Snack Store in Charleston.
And you really have to transport yourself back to the consumer mindset of 2008 to understand this. The iPhone 3G had literally just launched a few weeks prior.
It was peak Apple hysteria.
Exactly. The App Store was brand new. Apple was the absolute center of the cultural universe. So a new store opening wasn't just retail, it was an event.
And Big Fatty describes a scene of pure mania. He says the place was so intensely packed that they had to have actual police officers stationed at the front doors just to manage the flow of human bodies.
People are elbowing each other just to get inside.
And in true early internet fashion, Big Fatty makes sure to post pictures of the free promotional t-shirts they were handing out to the crowd. He is fully participating in this massive, polished, corporate tech worship.
But the truly defining moment of this Apple Store visit, the thing he chooses to spend his valuable broadcast time dissecting, isn't the pristine technology or the sleek store design.
No, of course not.
It is a hyper-specific, totally bizarre observation he makes when he takes a detour into the public restroom.
Picture this, right? You are at the epicenter of 2008 technological innovation. You go into the bathroom, and Big Fatty witnesses what he assumes is a phenomenon specific only to older men.
It's so strange.
He describes watching a man actively ignore the zipper on his shorts. Instead, this man aggressively hikes his shorts all the way up and then physically reaches down to pull his anatomy out through the bottom of the shorts leg to pee.
It is a complete logistical nightmare. I mean, Big Fatty admits he absolutely does not understand the mechanics or the reasoning behind it.
Who would?
Right. But the visual is so jarring that it leaves him feeling, in his own words, a little dirty-ish for the rest of the entire weekend.
I have to push back here, though. Why share this? He has 20 minutes. He could talk about the incredible charity work, the successful basket raffle, the excitement of the Apple Store.
He could be boasting.
Exactly. Instead, he dedicates airtime to the logistics of an older man's bizarre urination habits. It feels like he is intentionally undercutting his own polished, successful weekend.
What's fascinating here is that this intentional undercutting is the foundational strategy of his broadcast.
Really?
Yeah, think about it. If he only talked about raising money for charity and doing theatrical rehearsals, he becomes a polished, untouchable figure. He becomes arrogant.
Ah, I see.
But by immediately pivoting to the grotesque reality of a public restroom, he acts as a pressure valve for his own ego. He forces the narrative back down into the gutter, reminding the audience that no matter how successful the weekend was, we all still exist in these absurd, messy biological bodies.
And speaking of messy biological bodies, that feeling of being dirty-ish is just the appetizer for Tuesday's broadcast.
Oh, no.
Because on Tuesday, the physical reality of his body completely hijacking the narrative reaches its absolute peak. He introduces the audience to a deeply physiological, almost terrifying phenomenon that he officially dubs the vacation poop.
The level of visceral detail he provides here is it's something most people wouldn't even share with their own doctor.
He paints a picture of pure biological panic. He explains exactly what happens to his internal organs when he returns home to his apartment building after a long trip.
It's like a ticking time bomb.
He describes how, the moment he steps into the elevator with his luggage, a countdown begins. As that elevator gets closer and closer to his specific floor, his colon, or as he specifically highlights, his sphincter begins to pinch tighter and tighter.
He essentially posits that the psychological comfort of returning to your own home is the most powerful laxative on the planet.
Yeah.
The brain signals to the gut that the sanctuary has been reached, and the body just, you know, initiates an emergency evacuation protocol.
He tells the audience that he literally has to unlock his front door, drop his suitcases right in the middle of the living room floor, and sprint directly to the bathroom.
He doesn't even unpack.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Because he admits, with graphic, unblinking honesty, that if he hesitates for even a second, he's going to suffer a colonic explosion in his underpants.
Oh my God.
And he clarifies that this wouldn't just be an accident, it would be an event so catastrophic that the underpants would legally have to be burned.
Yeah, he then turns this horrifying confession into an interactive community segment.
Because of course he does.
Right. He puts the question directly to you, the listener, asking if you also suffer from the vacation poop phenomenon. He demands to note other people's bodies also completely give up the moment they see their own front door.
But I keep coming back to the extreme juxtaposition. It's like a politician delivering an incredibly dignified, unifying State of the Union address and then immediately leaning into the microphone to loudly burp just to prove he's one of the guys.
That's a great way to put it.
Why does he feel this mandatory, almost compulsive need to take the noble reality of a charity fundraiser and drown it in the absolute most grotesque, humiliating bodily realities imaginable?
Because that is how you build an unbreakable parasocial bond.
Okay, tell me more.
Well, we are taught by modern social media algorithms to only show our highlight reels, the perfect coffee, the flawless vacation sunset, but that creates distance. It creates envy, not loyalty.
Right, it feels fake.
Exactly. By sharing a universal, shameful, deeply biological urge like the vacation poop, Big Fatty completely levels the playing field. He bonds the listener to him through these shared, unspoken, messy human realities.
He's making himself human.
He is communicating a crucial message. I might be doing great things out in the community, but behind closed doors, my biology is just as flawed, urgent, and embarrassing as yours.
And that vulnerability is actually a strategic setup. Because having just laid bare his absolute most messy, vulnerable physical state on Tuesday, he uses Wednesday's broadcast to execute a complete 180-degree turn.
The pivot is incredible.
He shifts from physical helplessness to aggressive, authoritarian community management. He has to regain control.
It is a textbook psychological pivot. When you expose your soft underbelly, you must immediately remind the pack that you are still the alpha.
Yeah.
And he begins this reassertion of dominance by embracing the very labels that his critics think will destroy him.
On episode 129, he actually plays an audio clip from an entirely different podcast where the hosts are openly discussing Big Fatty online. And these other hosts are brutal.
They really hold nothing back.
They describe his show as a guilty pleasure, which is inherently a backhanded compliment. But then one host goes further and literally calls the BFO universe a train wreck. They describe him as a guy with a twanging accent who talks about absolutely nothing.
They attempt to humiliate him based on age and content. They joke that he is ancient, claiming he is far older than anyone in their studio room.
And then there's the diaper comment.
Yes. The final punchline from this rival podcast is a warning to their own listeners. They tell their audience that if they tune into Big Fatty, they better make sure they are wearing diapers, implying that the sheer shock or absurdity of his show will cause them to soil themselves.
Now, a normal creator in 2008 or today really would either ignore that clip entirely or play it and then spend 20 minutes defensively justifying their art.
They'd read off their download numbers.
They would argue about their charity work. But Big Fatty doesn't do that. He just sits there, plays the devastating critique to his entire audience, and completely owns the train wreck identity.
He leans right into it.
He essentially says, yes, I am a train wreck. Yes, I talk about nothing. And yet, you cannot look away.
By absorbing the insult, he completely neutralizes its power. It is an incredibly sophisticated media tactic. He robs his critics of their ammunition by agreeing with them.
Right.
But while he is perfectly happy to accept being called a train wreck by outsiders, he is utterly ruthless when it comes to the loyalty of his own internal community.
This is where the broadcast turns into a digital dictatorship. He initiates a roll call. He literally takes attendance on the air like a disappointed school principal glaring over a pair of reading glasses.
It's so intense.
He starts actively publicly calling out listeners by name who he suspects have pod-faded.
We need to explain the mechanics of pod-fading in 2008. Today, a creator looks at a dashboard and sees exactly how many unique streams they got in the last hour.
We have so much data now.
But in 2008, RSS feeds were essentially blind. You threw an MP3 file out into the digital void. The only way you knew someone was actually listening was if they engaged, if they sent an email, left a comment on the blog, or called the voicemail line.
So if someone stops calling.
Exactly. When a regular caller goes silent, the creator feels an acute, terrifying sense of abandonment.
And Big Fatty weaponizes that fear. He calls out Sharon Fluids by name. He notes that the last time he heard a peep from her was when she mailed him a massive physical box of condoms to take down to a Gay Days event.
Which is a memorable piece of mail.
It really is. And because she has been silent since, he openly guesses on air that she has given up the ghost.
He is publicly shaming her for her silence. And he doesn't stop there. He reads down the list. He calls out Turniphead, demanding to know what the deal is.
He names Tara from Flint, Michigan.
He singles out Zipper in Los Angeles, publicly assuming that Zipper is unsubscribed. He questions the loyalty of David in Denver and Michael in Portland. He is forcing his audience to publicly account for their lack of engagement.
Look, I have to ask the obvious question here. If you are listening to a show and the host aggressively calls you out by name, accusing you of unsubscribing and essentially guilt-tripping you for just quietly enjoying the content, doesn't that make you want to sprint in the opposite direction?
You'd think so, right?
Why wouldn't this aggressive roll call just alienate the very people he is trying to retain?
Because of the psychological dynamic he has built. It creates a highly active, slightly anxious community. If he didn't care about you, he wouldn't notice you were gone.
Oh, I see. It's almost flattering in a twisted way.
Yes. By calling you out, he is signaling that your specific presence matters to the survival of the show. You don't want to be on the pod fader list because it means you are letting the community down. It perversely makes listeners want to call in immediately just to prove their devotion.
So he is managing his listeners with an iron fist, but he takes that exact same aggressive, dominant energy and applies it to the broader pop culture landscape. If the listeners are his subjects, pop culture is his battleground.
Pop culture is the proxy he uses to establish his moral and aesthetic authority. He unleashes a torrential roundup this week, starting with a massive scandal that had just broken on TMZ regarding the legendary game show The Price is Right.
He details the mechanics of how the famous Plinko game was exposed. The producers had secretly rigged the Plinko board, pre-setting the peg so that the chips would hit the $10,000 slot every single time.
They just wanted a nice shot for a commercial.
They did this just so they could shoot a visually perfect promotional commercial.
But the mechanism of the scandal is brilliant. A producer made a bonehead mistake and forgot to reset the board back to its random, chaotic state before they let the actual studio audience in.
So during the actual taping, a regular contestant steps up, drops the chips, and miraculously racks up $30,000 because the board is still secretly rigged.
Imagine the panic in the control room.
Big Fatty meticulously details how the panicked producers had to stop the tape, unfix the game, and force the woman to play again, where she only won $3,000.
Oh, that's terrible for her.
But because of legal liability, the show still had to quietly hand her the $30,000 as a parting gift while completely editing the entire humiliating incident out of the television broadcast.
He clearly loves exposing the cracks in the polished facade of mainstream media. It reinforces his brand. The mainstream is fake and rigged, while the fat cave is messy but honest.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
And he applies that same ruthless, critical eye to the reality television of the era.
He provides this ongoing, venomous commentary on Big Brother, specifically noting the schedule change moving the show to Thursdays. But his real target is a bodybuilder contestant named Jesse.
He hates Jesse.
Big Fatty describes him with pure, unadulterated disdain, calling him arrogant as hell and actively demanding that the universe send him home.
But his critique of the reality show The Baby Borrowers is where his vocabulary gets truly aggressive and unrestrained. This is a controversial show where teenage couples were tasked with taking care of toddlers and infants to show them the realities of parenting.
He uses the specific term cuntiness to describe the attitude of the teenage couples on the show.
He does not hold back.
He details the specific interpersonal drama, noting that Dayton and Morgan, a couple from San Diego, had so much toxic conflict that Dayton actually got sick of Morgan's attitude and abandoned the show entirely.
And he doesn't hold back on the other couple either.
No, calling the girl Kelly contagious and vile and stating flat out that her boyfriend Austin is just foolish for sticking around.
Notice the transition happening here. You see Big Fatty managing his digital community with threats of cod fading, and he attacks reality TV stars with total, unwavering confidence.
Right.
And what makes him such a compelling broadcaster is that he takes that exact same hyper-localized, highly opinionated, incredibly dismissive lens and applies it to massive global economic and natural disasters.
This is where we cross from episodes 129 into 130, and the scale of his hubris becomes breathtaking. We are talking about macroeconomics and terrifying micro-disasters being treated with the exact same level of annoyance as a bad reality TV contestant.
He starts by addressing a severe earthquake that had just violently struck Southern California. This is a tectonic event that caused real fear and structural damage.
But Big Fatty completely refuses to respect the scale of the disaster. He addresses the California earthquake by comparing it to the physical reality of his day job.
He brings it right back to the coal mine.
Exactly. He tells the audience that at the cracker factory, where he sits in his miserable cubicle in the coal mine, the floor bounces like a cheap trampoline anyway. He jokes that whenever a heavy person walks past his desk, the floor shakes so violently he can't even tell if it's a real California earthquake hitting the East Coast or just a fat person walking to the break room.
He physically shrinks a terrifying natural disaster down to the size of his office floor. He refuses to let the world be bigger or scarier than his immediate surroundings.
It's all about his perspective.
And simultaneously, he is dealing with severe weather alerts hitting his own area in Charleston, right on hump day. He mentions watching the weather radar on TV, listening to the alarm bells, and his only real concern is hoping the podcast recording won't be interrupted by a power outage.
And then he tackles the 2008 gas crisis. And we have to remind people what this felt like. In the summer of 2008, fuel prices were causing legitimate national panic.
It was devastating for people.
The cost of commuting was bankrupting people. It was a massive source of existential dread. But Big Fatty delivers a triumphant report to his audience. He announces that as he was driving to his theatrical Buxy Blues rehearsal, he noticed gas prices at his local Charleston BP station had actually dropped to $3.79 a gallon.
He points out that other podcasters across the country are complaining about paying well over $4, leading him to smugly claim that Charleston might just have the cheapest gas in the entire country.
But he cannot just report the economic data. He has to completely ruin it with his brand of humor.
Of course.
He jokes that the only reason Charleston has an overabundance of cheap fuel is simply because Big Fatty himself is so incredibly gassy that he is personally supplying the local refineries.
Think about the psychological function of that joke. He takes a complex, terrifying global macroeconomic crisis that is ruining lives, and he reduces it to a highly localized fart joke.
Which ironically ties perfectly into his dietary updates on episode 130. He celebrates the official end of National Baked Bean Month.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
He actually takes the time to formally thank the National Baked Bean Board for supposedly sponsoring the BFO. He recites the classic childhood rhyme about beans being the magical fruit, gleefully adding that the more you eat them, the more you toot.
And what proves that this strategy works is how his audience responds. This dietary ruination is actively validated by his listeners.
Oh, they love it.
They do. He plays a voice letter from his own daughter, Holly. And Holly calls in to confirm that eating chocolate iced and Tenman's donuts for dinner is actually a completely balanced, respected family tradition in their household.
He even gets a massive victory from his aggressive community management. One of the specific listeners he called out during his Podfader shaming actually responds.
David in Denver, right?
Yes. David in Denver sends an e-letter desperately confirming that he has absolutely not Podfaded. He reassures Big Fatty that he looks forward to every single episode. And in a bizarre show of loyalty, David sends spankings back to the host as a sign of deep affection and continued presence.
It is brilliant. By reducing a crippling gas crisis to a self-deprecating fart joke, by equating a seismic earthquake to a heavy footstep outside his cubicle, and by validating the eating of chocolate donuts for dinner, he acts as a psychological filter.
He's sheltering them.
Exactly. He provides his listeners with a safe, humorous, and highly structured escape from the crushing real-world anxieties of 2008. He takes a massive, scary world and makes it feel small, manageable, and hilarious.
But that masterful control over his environment, that incredible ability to reduce global crises to a punchline, perfectly sets the stage for what happens next. Because his absolute blinding hubris finally collides with a digital disaster that he mistakenly believes he has under total control.
Yes, it is time to formally correct the historical record.
Attention listeners, it is explicitly time for the Ruin Ruination segment to correct the archives of the BFO universe. We are looking at the great Ryan Starr Jones iTunes saga spanning episodes 130 and 131.
The incident begins innocently enough on Thursday. A highly dedicated listener named Ryan Starr Jones sends in a technical complaint. He notes that the BFO podcast episodes are failing to download properly through iTunes.
Now, we have to remember how high the stakes were for downloading a podcast in 2008. You couldn't just stream it over a 4G cellular network while walking down the street.
No, you had to physically plug your iPod into your desktop computer.
Right, with that giant 30-pin cable. Open the iTunes application and wait for the RSS feed to sync. If that file didn't download before you left the house, you literally did not have the episode for your commute. So Ryan Starr Jones is reporting a critical failure.
And Big Fatty's reaction is swift, merciless, and entirely defensive. He goes on the attack.
He really does.
He aggressively denies on air that there is any issue whatsoever with his podcast feed.
Yeah.
He explicitly blames Ryan's computer, essentially telling him that his personal hardware is fundamentally flawed. He tells Ryan that he lives in a glass house for daring to accuse the BFO of technical incompetence.
But he doesn't just verbally reprimand him. That wouldn't be enough. He issues a moral mandate.
Oh, this part is wild.
He tells Ryan Starr Jones that as penance for making this false, insulting insinuation against the flawless Big Fatty online infrastructure, Ryan must perform exactly 2 random acts of kindness by Friday to clear his name and re-enter the community's good graces.
It is an astonishing display of arrogance. He is demanding charitable penance for a tech support ticket. But the truth always comes out. Hmm. And the truth arrives on Friday, August 1st.
The revelation on Friday is an absolute masterpiece of linguistic backtracking. It turns out Ryan Starr Jones was completely 100% right.
Vindicated.
Completely. The downloads were entirely broken. But it wasn't Big Fatty's RSS feed, and it certainly wasn't Ryan's faulty computer. It was a massive system-wide Apple iTunes software glitch that was actively breaking podcast downloads to iPods on a global scale.
Big Fatty is forced to announce on air that he hopes there won't be any other problems downloading the show. He casually mentions that listeners can always just bypass Apple entirely and download the MP3 directly from his website if the iPod sync fails again.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because Big Fatty's reaction to this crisis is astounding. Imagine a restaurant owner whose dining room roof is visibly caving in during a rainstorm. Instead of apologizing to the diners who are getting soaked, he aggressively insists the roof is fine, blames the customers for wearing the wrong clothes, and then when the roof finally collapses, he tries to charge them an extra fee for a premium indoor waterfall experience. He is so incredibly confident in his own authority that even when faced with a global tech failure, he never yields.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you realize that this is exactly what makes Big Fatty such an enduring broadcaster. He understands that a cult of personality relies on the illusion of infallibility.
Fake it till you make it, basically.
More like never admit you were faking it. When he's proven objectively, factually wrong by a multi-billion-dollar tech conglomerate's glitch, he simply absorbs the new information, blames the conglomerate, and gracefully. In utter defeat.
And having miraculously survived the total technological collapse of the iTunes ecosystem without apologizing, Big Fatty immediately retreats to what he does absolutely best.
Back to basic.
Yep. He pivots to asserting his personal magnetic allure and anchoring his chaotic life in deeply intimate historical milestones.
This brings us to the remainder of Friday's broadcast, episode 131. And it starts with the thrilling announcement of a highly anticipated house guest.
He receives breaking news via an e-letter during the first 3 minutes of the broadcast. Brian from Boston, a man who holds the highly esteemed title of the show's resident historian, is planning a giant summer road trip.
A momentous occasion.
And Brian specifically reaches out to ask if Big Fatty will be around the South Kakalaki, which is their deeply affectionate localized term for South Carolina, during the last week of August.
We have to establish who Brian from Boston is within the lore. He's a legendary figure in the BFO community, primarily known for getting completely hammered at a specific bar called the Boston Eagle and then calling into the show's voicemail line.
And Big Fatty openly, brazenly admits on air that hearing Brian's voice, especially when Brian admits he is hammered at the Eagle, makes him want to touch himself appropriately. It is a wildly explicit confession. And his response to Brian's potential visit matches that energy. He assures Brian that he will absolutely host him at the villa. He guarantees that there will be queen sheets on the visitor's bed.
Okay, that's nice.
And then, in a moment of pure, unfiltered, jaw-dropping hospitality, he promises that he will give the sling a good wipe down before Brian arrives.
It is such a jarring collision of concepts. He flawlessly blends the deeply mundane domestic duties of hosting a guest, washing the guest room sheets, with the highly explicit taboo realities of maintaining his lifestyle furniture.
But the whiplash isn't over, because from that incredibly taboo, explicit invitation regarding the leather sling, he immediately, without taking a breath, pivots to dignified historical reflection.
The shift is so fast it gives you vertigo.
The arrival of August means it is the host's birthday month.
He notes that he was born in 1956, meaning he is preparing to turn 52 years old. And because he is a community manager first and foremost, he also respectfully notes that a beloved listener, Ms. West, has a birthday coming up on August 9th, ensuring she gets her proper, dignified recognition from the audience.
But to mark the occasion of his own birth year, he decides to execute a deep dive into the historical trivia of 1956. He wants to see what things cost and what the geopolitical world looked like when he was born.
Which is actually a fun idea.
And the facts he pulls are genuinely fascinating. He mentions he actually thought about this entire segment while sitting and eating breakfast at a Bob Evans restaurant, which perfectly ties back to the cultural era he is referencing.
He begins listing major technological shifts from 1956. He notes the impending death of kinescopes, explaining that CBS had just started utilizing videotape for the very first time, which revolutionized broadcasting.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
He highlights the incredible consumer fact that RCA managed to sell 90,000 color television sets that specific year, bringing a new dimension to American living rooms.
And he doesn't stop at mid-century television tech. He dives headfirst into heavy, world-altering global politics.
He really goes for it.
He reads to his audience that in 1956, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev delivered a monumental secret speech denouncing the former dictator Joseph Stalin before the 20th Communist Party Congress in Moscow.
And sprinkled amidst this heavy history, he even briefly celebrates an internal podcast network victory, noting his joy that a fellow show called the Gay Trucker Podcast has finally returned to actually talking about the logistics of trucking, shedding its highly redundant and confusing former title of The Gay Hairdresser.
Let's just map the trajectory of the single broadcast. He goes from offering to wipe down a sex sling for a hammered house guest, to discussing the death of the kinescope, to analyzing the geopolitical fallout of Nikita Khrushchev denouncing Joseph Stalin. Wait, I mean, he does all of this within the exact same 20-minute file.
This raises an important question about how he meticulously constructs his identity for the audience. If you analyze his use of chronological history, these heavy, factual, indisputable 1956 trivia points, you see that they serve a vital structural purpose.
How so?
They give weight, gravity, and intellectual dignity to his life. This historical anchoring acts as a direct, absolutely necessary counterbalance to the highly taboo, explicit talk about wiping down the sling.
Oh, I get it now. It balances him out.
Exactly. He manages to simultaneously position himself as the respected, highly knowledgeable elder statesman of the podcasting network while remaining its absolute most scandalous, boundary-pushing participant. He literally requires the heavy history to justify the explicit ruination.
It is a masterful high-wire balancing act. When you synthesize this entire journey, the emotional and psychological whiplash of this single five-day stretch is just breathtaking.
It really is a roller coaster.
You start with the agonizing, highly relatable, and deeply gross physical reality of the vacation poop. Then you are plunged into the aggressive, demanding loyalty checks of a dictator calling out his silent pod faders by name.
You watch him blindly, arrogantly fight an unwinnable war with the Apple iTunes infrastructure.
You watch him demand random acts of kindness as penance from an innocent listener, and then seamlessly pivot to preparing a leather sling for a house guest while reciting mid-century Soviet history.
It is the absolute complete spectrum of the human experience, the sacred and the profane, delivered in daily 20-minute increments.
Which leaves you, the listener, with a final, lingering, and frankly provocative question to mull over. In our modern era of hyper-curated, flawlessly filtered social media, we are constantly taught to only show our best angles.
We want everything to look perfect.
Right. We are told to highlight our successes, hide our messes, and present a polished magazine spread to the world. But looking at the fierce, unwavering loyalty of the big, fatty online audience, an audience willing to hand over cash in a recession and accept public shaming just to belong, does the path to building a truly unbreakable community actually require the opposite?
That's the real question.
Does true loyalty require you to share your absolute worst, most humiliating, and completely unvarnished mistakes? Is stepping into the mud wrestling match actually more compelling than wearing the tuxedo?
It is the ultimate question of whether true, lasting connection requires true, unfiltered ruin.
Think about that the next time you try to hide a messy mistake from the world. I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
Tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, The Early Years.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, The Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.